Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining me on this podcast, which is another reading from the book by Esther Vilar. And I hope you're getting something from the previous chapters. Very important book, this one. Okay, so the next chapter is The Female Libido. As it is difficult to test or classify the degree to which a woman feels sexual stimulation, or to define the exact nature of a female orgasm, men get into considerable difficulties when they try to analyze her capacity for sexual excitability and orgasm. If they make any attempt to come to conclusions on the subject, they are forced to rely to a large extent on the information women volunteer to them. And since women have no respect for exact scientific data and are interested only in what is of immediate benefit to them, they will say what seems to be convenient or opportune at the time. Consequently, any facts acquired on the subject of a woman's reactions, whether, for instance, she is frigid, to what degree she can enjoy sexual intercourse, or whether her own orgasm can be compared to that of a man, tend to be extremely contradictory. It is supposed that even Masters and Johnson did not get an average woman onto their test bed. As a result, man vacillates between the conviction that woman has no true sexual drive and the fear that she is more highly sexed than he is, but refrains from telling him so out of pity. He will spend days working out bigger, better, and subtler questionnaires in his efforts to come to some conclusion. And in the interest of science, he expects women to answer his questions truthfully, as if she could or would. It is probable that the truth lies somewhere between the two extremes. Certainly, women are not all nymphomaniacs, or they would be more male prostitutes. On the other hand, women do not feel an intense aversion to sex, as so often been maintained. Women live an animal existence. They like eating, drinking, sleeping, even sex, providing there is nothing to do and no real effort is required of them. Unlike a man, a woman will rarely make an effort to get her partner into bed. If, however, he is already there and she hasn't planned to set her hair or undertake some other form of large-scale beauty repair, and there is no TV program she wants to see, she will not be averse to making love, provided he is prepared to be the active partner. But even the euphemisms, active for the male partner and passive for the female, do not conceal the fact that woman allows man to serve her in bed, just as he does in every other sphere of her life. Even though intercourse may give man pleasure in the long run, it is nothing more than a service to a woman in which the man is the better lover, arousing desire more skillfully, quickly, and making it last longer. Men suspect that women tend to exploit them during intercourse, and they have developed a certain fear of female sexual appetite. Signs of this appear in the rites of ancient cultures in philosophical works of men such as Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, in the novels of Baudelaire, Balzac, and Motherland, in the plays by Strindberg, O'Neill, and Tennessee Williams. Since the discovery of oral contraceptives, this fear has reached almost hysterical proportions. Whole books are devoted to the question whether a man needs to worry about a woman's sexual demands, and if so, to what extent. And at the same time, advertising he has discovered new opportunities to make money by selling men advice on how to achieve sexual dexterity. In truth, reliable oral contraceptive invented by a man, naturally, have robbed man of the only triumph left to him in his state of sexual subjugation. Previously, woman was always to a certain extent at his mercy. Now, she is suddenly in control. She can have as many children as she wishes. She can even select the father, rich if possible. If she has no intention of having children, she can indulge in intercourse as often as it appears advantageous to her. Men cannot do that. He had always claimed that his sexual potency was without limit, and that he only needed an unreserved woman to prove it. Today, this is impossible. Any woman can read for herself in popular magazines exactly how potent men are. She will know how active he will be at any given age, whether his best time is afternoon or night, or if he is a better lover before or after a meal, and whether his prowess increases in the mountains or at the seashore. She knows how often he can make love on any one occasion in order to satisfy her. What is more, she can be sure of these statistics, for men would never cheat when giving information of this kind. A masculine man would consider it a sign of weakness to lie in any situation at all. So women can rely absolutely on the figures given and know exactly what a man should be able to achieve. He has provided her with charts to determine any man's potency at any given stage in his life, and thanks to efficient birth control methods, she can experiment with different kinds of men and compare their sexual performances. Contrary to men's fear, women do not, however, weigh one man against another and choose the most virile. Far from it, as she herself is not all that keen on sex. In view of that, and provided all other conditions are equal, she is likely to prefer the less potent man because she can always blackmail him with her intimate knowledge of his weakness. In the realm of sex, more than any other, man is a victim of the principles of efficiency according to which he is manipulated. Indeed, he sets his own standards three times in a row, very good, twice, good, once, satisfactory. If he fails as a sex machine, he is, in his opinion, a total failure. Even if he is a brilliant scientist, he will never again be really happy. Women know this and take advantage. For example, A. She can pretend she is unaware of her husband's lack of virility and continue to praise him for his prowess, probably the most frequent method applied. B. She can make a man believe his sexual failure is a real handicap, so that he considers himself lucky she stays with him. C. She can threaten to expose his sexual inadequacy unless he does everything she wants, since a man would rather be called a thief or a murderer than impotent, he will bow his head to his fate and do what he is told. Man's sexual potency depends on psychological factors more than any other of his bodily functions. Once he has begun to doubt his potency, he gradually finds himself in more and more difficulty. His fears of becoming useless to a woman increase, because as a result of woman's manipulation, he identifies his masculinity with his dependence on them. For this reason, he will resort to every possible means to remain dependent. One really should reflect on this absurdity of this situation. Aphrodisiacs, once hidden discreetly under the counter and usually prepared by quacks, have long since become socially acceptable and are among the best-selling products of the pharmaceutical industry. Even in serious publications, the number of articles on sexual difficulties is increasing, and men's rim jokes, which, as we all know, are the result of man's castration anxieties, are heard more frequently, though they are usually quite humorous, and men certainly do not buy pornographic magazines for pleasure. There are so many better ways and more sophisticated ways of abusing themselves. Their interest lies solely in the hope of finding in such a powerful stimulation some means of retaining this mythical level of masculine virility. All this serves to make man, once again, the victim of his habit of thinking of women in terms of his own standards. He really believes that women, now safe from the dangers of conception, are thinking about nothing but how to make up for lost time, to spend the rest of their lives making love. This is a natural assumption, since he has been manipulated to think that sex is the height of all pleasure. He is, of course, quite mistaken. A woman will certainly feel happy when she has an orgasm, but it is not the most intense pleasure she knows. A cocktail party or buying a new pair of aubergine coloured patent leather boots rates far higher. Man's fear of losing ground at the sexual or physical level as a result of women's newfound freedom is, of course, quite absurd. No matter how much a woman enjoys making love, she will never let the man who supports her tire himself so that he might be late to work the next morning. That is too big a risk to take. Even the most passionate woman will reduce her sexual activities if she thinks nights spent making orgiastic love are beginning to affect his work. Nymphomaniacal women exist solely in films and plays. Just because they are so rare in real life, the public is curious about them. For the same reason so many films and novels are about extremely rich people, who form such a small percentage of the total population. There is only one aspect of a man's sexual potency that concerns a woman. Whether he is capable of fathering children or not. Children, as we shall see later, are essential to a woman if she is to bring her plans to fruition. It is probable that many women would be pleased if a man's need for sex dried up after she had produced two or three children. It would do away with numerous small inconveniences. That sexual competence in a man is a matter of indifference to the majority of females is shown by the number of highly paid men marry and stay married, despite the fact that they are impotent. It is inconceivable that a woman without a vagina would have any prospects whatsoever of getting married to a normally sexed man. And that's the end of that, again, mind-blowing chapter about, you know, men's attitude to sex there, really. It's very interesting, because there's so much, if you, you know, look at YouTube, there's so much, so many, you know, advice, there's so much advice about how to be a man, how to be masculine, you know, and all this type of thing, and to how to get women, how to be good in bed, how to have multiple partners, and all this PUA stuff, you know, and it's a lot of it is geared towards, you know, financial recompense from people, you know, the selling of courses, you know, to PUAs, they always sell a course, how to pick up women and things like this, and there's always some financial element to it, and how to be a man and how to be masculine. So, you know, it's all very much geared to the concept of keeping the woman sort of happy, isn't it, really? You know, it's all geared towards, you know, sexual prowess in this, as it is in this chapter. You know, the more masculine you are, the more sexually potent you are, and all of that, you know, that best serves a woman, actually. So the irony of all this is all those videos about how to be man, how to be masculine, is man's attempt to, or idea of what a woman wants, in a man, and what sort of a man can actually best serve her. You see, our terrible irony of all of these videos is the end game is what can best serve her needs. The more masculine you are, the more you serve her needs. And I'm not saying it's not good thing to be masculine, but of course it is, but it's something to bear in mind, how manipulated men are, and it goes so deep, doesn't it, that you know, the shaming if you're not sexually potent and all this, but at the end of the day, I don't think, as it says in the chapter, that doesn't really matter to women anyway. They're only really interested in, you know, the money and the children and providing benefits for her. I think they have this sort of phase of riding the carousel, and they, you know, have a lot of fun, I think, a lot of these girls in their teenage years. And they have a lot of, you know, male sexual relationships with men. And they have a lot of fun, I think. a lot of them, and then they quickly, very quickly, I think, realize that was just a bit of fun. It wasn't really very serious. So all those, Chads and Tyrones that they talk about on the internet, really, that is just a sort of phase. But I think she'll quickly realise that that isn't going to bring her resources and children. And she quickly realises that the Chads and the Tyrones aren't reliable enough for her. But she will have a fun, and I think that's the problem, really. That once she's done all this riding the carousel, and then wanting to settle down, she expects somebody to come along and be the beta male, simp, they call it, or the chump, I think. It's mentioned quite a bit. It's a really good book and a really good chapter, this, so I really highly recommend it, and I'll see you in the next chapter.